When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Ancient Warfare Answers. I'm Murray Dahm, the assistant editor of Ancient Warfare magazine, and with me is Jasper Ortage, the editor. Today, we are looking at the question, what did the aftermath of ancient battle look like?
Let's not do the standard we don't know, but because we know something. The problem is that our sources are so focused, you know, as always, they're focused on the generals, on the standout big men. And the standout big men are interested in the spoil and plunder, and, you know, setting up the tropaeum, the victory monument, which in the case of the Romans, you know, you go out in the nearby wood, hopefully you can find a nice big oak tree and you strip the branches off of it, and then you hang bloodied, preferably, equipment from your enemy on it, and that is your proof, your holy evidence that you have won a battle at that field, and that is left in place there until it rots away or just drops off or whatever, but that is the most important thing, and they take that from the Greeks. Tropaeum is a Greek word. To, you know, as evidence of winning a battle, and then there's, of course, you go and try and find the enemy baggage, and that's where the spoils and plunder are, and you might have to set up some kind of division of the spoils, where some of the soldiers get some, and some of the officers get some more, and the general get the most. You might have prisoners of war you can take to back to Rome, or to your home city if it was in Greece, where you might be able to sell them as slaves. That is all, you know. That's the victor has his way. And it can go, you know, can get pretty exuberant. If you look at the Actium Monument, we've talked about this more than once, I think, fairly recently, about when we had the podcast about ramming. The whole Actium Monument is one big tropaeum, because it is decorated with the rams of the fleet of Cleopatra and Antony. And again, in the case of the Romans, there might be at some point after the battle, especially if it was the culmination of a campaign, there might be a moment where the army is drawn up on parade, and the soldiers who stood out in the battle are called out and rewarded for their exploits. Which is, you know, one of the very few times that we know something about some of the more common soldiers, what their aftermath of battle might have been like. In a more practical sort of practical point of view, the Romans at least have, of course, a medical service, and we have to assume. I mean, we've had articles in Ancient Warfare about the hospitals and the medical service in the Roman army, how that worked in their camps. But from some of the Roman texts, like from Cornelius Celsus, who writes about Roman medicine in the first century AD, he describes how to treat certain battle wounds. There's a famous story about what to do about an arrow that has penetrated the flesh. He talks about whether it's, you know, you should try and pull it out, and there's a special instrument that can help you with that, and if it's too far in, you have to make a cut from the other side, and you can put it through, push it through, so that it does relatively less damage. There is clearly some knowledge about how to stem blood loss, how to even try and prevent infections. And there is knowledge about amputation if there's really no other choice about how to deal with the wound. So there's, you know, that's a very practical side of this, of the aftermath of battle. But we don't know very much about, say, burial. Although from archaeology we know of course the Tropaean Traiani, the monument in Adamklisi in modern Romania that Trajan had set up to bury the soldiers who had fallen in the Dacian Wars. And we know of Germanicus, who says he found the battlefield of the Varian disaster and there had gathered up all the bones of the Roman soldiers who fell in the battle and has them, I think he made into a funeral pyre and set up a monument. And of course, we're very familiar, all of us, with the Roman funerary practices and their famous tombstones, some of which actually, I think it is, if you counted it out, it's probably only a very small percentage, but some of which refer to the soldier having died in battle. The famous tombstone of Marcus Caelius is an example of that one. You've all seen it. He fell in the Varian disaster, but he's not buried there. The text actually says that it is a memorial to him, and if he's ever recovered, he can be buried there. I think those are the main points of what we know about the aftermath of battle. It's kind of interesting if you look at the literature that we're interested in the campaign, in the plans for battle, in the battle itself, the communication on the battlefield, you know, what happens at the point of breaking. This is when sort of when you might send the light cavalry after the enemy. And then it's the end of the war, but the direct aftermath, what do the soldiers do? Do they sit down and have a breather? Probably, but we don't really know.
Hmm. I think we've got, is it Scipio Aemilianus who goes missing for 2 days? And he's off killing fleeing survivors and then sort of shows up covered in blood. But yeah, pursuit. Pursuit's probably something that happens after battle as a norm.
Yeah. Yeah, no, as I said, in Arian says in the Tactica that that he has planned for the light cavalry to pursue the enemy when they break, and we have to assume that that's a lot of what they do. I mean, you might even think that the galloping, the triumphant rider tombstones that you see a lot, where the Roman cavalryman is shown charging across a barbarian, perhaps that's when he's what he's doing then.
What
he's
doing.
Pursuing.
Yeah, I suppose they must have, you know, packaged up some of the spoils to bring back to Rome for their triumphs as well. You know, we get the idea of Celtic shields and sarissas and all sorts of things brought back to a triumph in Rome. So they must have shipped off, you know, additional arms and weapons from the monument on the battlefield and taken them back, especially for a battle that was a culmination of a campaign and you were, you know, pitching to get a triumph out of it in the Republican period, then you would have all of that kind of material shipped back to Rome along with captives and remarkable sort of aspects of your campaign. So that's, I suppose, something else. So that all of that collecting would have taken time and personnel, and generally speaking, I think the personnel available were your soldiers. I suppose you could talk about piles of dead bodies. You know, several battles are about how, you know, even the Battle of Adrianople is treated in a similar way to the Varian disaster, that the, you know, the bones of the dead of Adrianople were visible several years later.
Which does not suggest that they were carefully collected.
No. But again, it's that sort of literary. The literary trope is that true, or is it just makes a good image, and you know the idea that
Or it depends on who won, perhaps.
Well, of course, but of course in Greek battle under a truce, one of the signs that you'd lost was under a truce you requested that you could collect your dead.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other was, of course, the erection of a trapion by the victor. So it's an interesting one in that sense that I think a lot of it, like there are several battles where they essentially get away as quickly as possible. So they win, they erect the trapion, and then they get out of there so that they're not going to be pursued or battle's not going to be renewed. And, you know, I think a lot of battles do end up in headlong rout. So, you know, they're not fleeing a few feet off the battlefield. They're running, like at the Battle of Delium, the retreat of the Athenians is all the way back to Athens. And all the way back to Athens, they're being pursued by Boeotian cavalry. So a lot of the carnage and the death after the battle occurs in the flight back. And that, of course, is where Socrates' example of how to, you know, be a proper hoplite and face your enemies as you walk calmly back is the way to deal with it, as opposed to headlong flight, you're in trouble. And I mean, you know, battles like Marathon, it's a flight to the ships. They flee back to the fleet. So the Battle of Marathon, there's no aftermath. They have to immediately march back to Athens because they're worried that the Persian fleet's going to make their way around to Athens by the harbour. So, you know, that the aftermath of that battle was a forced march of a marathon. So it's an interesting one in terms of all the different aftermaths of battle that we have any kind of detail of at all, because, you know, very often it's the march continued for a Caesar or an Alexander the Great, rather than any detail of any, you know, standard procedures, I suppose you would say.
Yeah, we can put in a lot of supposition, like they must have let their troops rest for a day and cook up a meal and stuff, if available. Because the logistics in the ancient world, well, we did an issue about that too. Actually, I should mention that we did a whole issue about the theme of what happens after a battle, issue 9-6. There's a podcast that you can probably find in your previous episodes on your podcast reader as well. So we talked about this before, but we can talk about these things endlessly, it seems.
Yes, 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 indeed. But
so we'll do that next time.
I think so.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.